All right, hello and welcome to, we're gonna call it the Jet Lag Guide to Travel. Here we have three technically professional travelers, right?
Professional athletes, more like.
Well, yeah.
I'm a professional travel athlete.
We can be both. We're both professional athletes, professional travelers, and professional travel athletes. And maybe even professional athlete travelers. I don't know about that one. But anyways, we have three people who travel and make money via traveling and therefore do it professionally. Actually, technically a lot of people do that, but...
Explain it more. Keep explaining the concept.
No, I refuse. That's it. That's the context. But unrelated to Adam's request, I think, I'm trying to think of a way out of this, we're going to basically walk through all the things that we've learned through the year of doing this and outside travel and kind of give our advice, give our tips, give our opinions about various travel controversies like whether to check a bag, I think. Really need to maybe put more thought into these intros before going into them sometimes, but that's the pitch, right?
It's all part of our charm.
I would agree that that is the pitch.
Well, let's start with starting, right? Yes. Okay, cheap flights. How do we find them?
Google Flights.
You guys want to hear a really fun little behind the scenes fact about the podcast? Our cat pooped in the plant that I keep in my office. And I meant to text Maeve that, but I accidentally texted Ben. So Ben just got a text with no context that said he pooped in the plant again.
I thought you were talking about Sam and it was like code for something. And I was like, that's an interesting innuendo.
Yeah, it seems like a very coded way of saying that I did a bad job of the intro.
Yeah, he pooped the plant.
Yeah. Sam totally pooped in the plant today, man.
All right, now find a way to segue that into cheap flights.
Cheap flights.
You know what's a real pooping in the plant move? Paying too much for flights.
So true.
Yeah.
I mean, how to find cheap flights? I mean, any of us can talk about this. I feel like I gained the most experience by far with this studying circumnavigation. And folks, it's all about a little function called Google Flights Explore.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess one thing to keep in mind is we're going to be talking about a few different contexts of travel. There's like the, I just want to travel because I love traveling and have free time and want to go on vacation or something. There's the, I am a traveler who needs to get here at this time and have this defined plan and stuff like that, and therefore need to do this kind of travel. And then we're going to be talking about both of those in the rather slightly more niche context of I'm in a nationwide game of Connect Four and need to get to a state that leads to a straight line anyways, that's to say some of our context comes from rather niche circumstances, but what's true is that you can find a lot of cheap flights if you have flexibility.
Yes. All about flexibility.
Yeah. Flexibility really counts for a lot because basically how airlines price their flights, they're essentially trying to do price segmentation. They know that leisure travelers make a lot of decisions based on price, based on how much something costs, whereas business travelers are really like schedule dependent. They not only will need to go from here to here on a certain day, they'll need to go from here to here at a certain time on a certain day. So therefore, you know, there are often really like inconvenient flight times, like at 6 a.m. or 10 p.m. or something like that, that are cheap because they might be more for leisure travelers. And airlines know that they can capture that market through having a low price on those flights. But yeah, tell us more about the Google Flights Explore tool.
So, I mean, it's a very simple tool. If you just go to flights.google.com, right here, I'm going to go to it to make sure I actually correctly tell you what to do. So if you go to flights.google.com, you'll be taken to this thing. And then up at the top, you'll see this bar and it says Travel Explore, Things to Do, Flights, Hotels, Vacation Rentals. Things to Do, by the way, another great tab that we can talk about later. But if you just hit Explore and then it'll put you in, I mean, for me, it says New York, but you can put in whatever city you'll be starting from. And then you have all of these ways to filter like what you want, but it shows you all these options. So like right now, it just says a 1 week trip sometime in the next 6 months. And it's showing me round trip fares to a number of places. So it's like, if you want, you could go to Paris for $437 round trip. You could go to Milan for $438 round trip. You could go all the way to New Delhi, India for $702 round trip. And then there are lots and lots of tabs and like filters that you can use to fine tune what you're looking for.
We used these sort of very extensively when we were doing circumnavigation, but like you can put certain time windows in there because obviously like there are people who never want to take red eye flights and you can filter those out. You can, I don't know. What do you want me to talk about with the filters? The filters aren't very interesting.
I don't know. You can talk about how like instead of doing a 1 week trip the next 6 months, you can tell it what month you want, but not like the specific like days that you want. You can change the length. You can say that you want nonstops, et cetera, et cetera. Like you can just like really narrow down what you're looking for.
Yeah, I think that's the message. The filters are very helpful for narrowing it down. And so it's worth playing with them. Another thing that I would add, one thing to keep in mind in general, which is actually something that Ben and Adam, I remember it being something that you learned in kind of the early seasons somewhat. And I remember initially with simulation, this being one of the things when we were like simulating, I think all the way back with like Crime Spree, this being one of the ways that I was beating you that you eventually learned is alternate airports.
Mm-hmm.
Alternate airports are really useful. So, you know, if you're based in Washington, D.C., for example, of course, you have like National Airport right there downtown and you have Dulles Airport. And I think everyone pretty much knows that you have BWI Airport for Baltimore. But the other thing to keep in mind is like you could always fly out of like Philadelphia. You could take Amtrak up to Philadelphia. And of course, you wouldn't do it for the same price, but it might just be that there's a flight for like $200 less out of Philadelphia. So it's worth paying $50 for the Northeast Regional up to Philadelphia. Or even, you know, on the Northeast Corridor, the real hack is that Newark Airport is on the Amtrak line. So you can often get to Newark Airport really easily from Boston, from Philadelphia, from DC. So Newark Airport's a big airport. You can book the train right to it. And therefore, it's often, you know, just as easy as a connecting flight. So make sure to check alternate airports, both at your origin and destination. They won't always be ones that show up. Like if you put New York City in, you know, you normally include LaGuardia Airport, JFK Airport, and Newark Airport, but it definitely won't include like Philadelphia Airport. So you have to do that a little bit more manually. Do you guys want to know a fun fact?
I'd love to know a fun fact, Sam.
Yes.
I forget if you guys know this or not. I think you might not, actually. But one of the show concepts that eventually kind of metamorphized into jet lag was kind of based on the Google Flights Explore tool. And it was actually greenlit. It was actually like budget approved and everything for a pilot run. It was going to be called Jet Roulette. Does this ring a bell?
Oh, you told us.
Oh,
about
you've
this.
Told me yeah. about this. Yeah, you've told us about this.
Yeah. Well, the idea was basically, think about it, actually has some decent parallels. It was essentially going to be a travel show where the idea was that I would pair up with a partner and it was going to be more like off the cuff travel. But the way that the travel was going to be decided was that each day we would just take the cheapest flight available from the place that we were onward. So let's say we were in Denver leaving today, one-way flight. So let's find what the cheapest flight would be. No surprise, it's Vegas. So we would just fly from Denver to Vegas. And then tomorrow we would take the cheapest flight out of Vegas and so on and so forth. And we would just do this for like a week, kind of exploring each stop as we went. And I was actually going to film an initial episode of this in Australia. But what happened was that just when I was about to film, I had a death in the family. So I flew back to the US for that. And then I got back and ran out of time. And then pretty soon after that, COVID happened. So it kind of just like various unrelated things got in the way. But it got pretty close to that. And I'm in a way glad that that didn't go through because I think what happened eventually was that we came up with an even better show format based on kind of some of the same ideas. But it would have been interesting. Maybe that's a game mechanic we'll use one day.
It could be fun.
Cheapest flight mechanic.
We've certainly talked about it.
I like it.
I will say that this brings up one more thing about cheap flights, which is like, I think not a lot of people realize how cheap it is to get to Vegas.
Oh, yeah.
But like the reason for that is like, subsidized flights are always like the cheapest way to fly. And this is why alternate airports can be really useful is like sometimes, especially with like big touristy vacation destinations like Iceland, the airlines are subsidized for like certain flights. So like if you want to go to Iceland and you don't have an airport that like has Iceland Air, which is going to be by far the cheapest situation, then like getting to an airport that does. Like, I think it's really cheap to fly to Iceland from Baltimore.
From Washington.
Yeah, but they're not actually subsidized. They're just budget airlines.
Isn't Iceland Air subsidized by Iceland?
No, it's a privately held airline now. So it's not government owned. There are cases of that. I don't think Iceland is the perfect example because Iceland Air is, I'm just double checking. It's not government owned anymore, I don't believe. But like, for example, an example of this would be like Emirates. Like Emirates is owned by, I think it has a variety of owners, but some of them include like the royal families of the different Emirates in the United Arab Emirates, I believe. So it's not necessarily directly subsidized, but it's a situation in which the airline is often operating at a, like a lot of Middle Eastern airlines operate at a loss. The incentive for that is that they're publicly owned. Well, not always publicly, but they're kind of owned by the state or the monarchies. And therefore, it's accepted that they operate at a loss as a way to bring in people to the country. So like, that's kind of the case with the Emirates. It's kind of the case with Qatar Airways. It's kind of the case with like the Saudi Arabian Airlines and stuff like that.
Yeah, flying through the Middle East is often a cheap way to get around.
Yeah.
The last thing I'll mention on Google Flights optimization is just if you want to go somewhere specific, you can still use Google Flights quite well to figure out the cheapest days or times to leave by using the filters effectively. Like I recently had to fly out of Houston where I was for a wedding, and flying out back to New York on Tuesday was like $350 cheaper than flying back on Sunday, which was less than the cost of staying for an extra 2 days. And the only reason I knew that was that I used Google Flights with various filters where I had selected what day I was leaving and where I wanted to get back to, but I hadn't selected the day I wanted to go back. And then you can look at all the options and find what you want.
Yeah, I think I have two final tips on Google Flights. One thing to keep in mind is Google Flights will not show you Southwest Airlines in the US.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Southwest Airlines, it does not distribute through the GDS, which is the system that Google Flights uses to get its data. It'll show you schedules usually, but it'll put them way at the bottom and it won't show fares. So sometimes Southwest will be cheaper. So if you're in a city that has a lot of Southwest flights in the US, at least, it's often worth checking their website. And the other thing is don't book with Expedia. Basically, don't book with anything except the airline itself, unless you really, really need to. It is very, very, very rare that the fares are less through something like Expedia. But the problem is when you book through Expedia, your booking is essentially owned and managed by Expedia. So when you have an issue, you have to talk to Expedia, not the airline. And Expedia customer service and everything is almost always going to be worse and less flexible than the airline itself. So it's always worth booking directly with the airline because then, you know, if there's a cancellation or something, once you're in it, once you're actually flying, the airline will always handle it. But if there's like a cancellation in advance, you'll have to deal with Expedia rather than, you know, say United Airlines to get it fixed.
Just to be clear, though, just to mention, Google Flights has you book through the airline.
Well, it usually gives you a bunch of options.
Right, right. But most of the time when you book, it'll direct you usually toward the airline.
Yeah. But yeah, it's worth making sure that you're booking with the airline unless you're going to save like a ton through something like Expedia. But again, that's very, very rare. There are a couple quick other ways that you can save money through flights. One of them is, for example, with using points. I could talk about that for hours. So the one thing that I'll say is, especially if you're in the US, if you are spending money on a debit card over a credit card, you're just throwing money away because the points that you get through credit card spend, you spend the same amount of money yourself. What happens when you use a credit card is a slightly bigger chunk of the processing fee goes to the credit card company, and the credit card company, in return, to incentivize you to do that, gives you points back. So essentially, you can always get those points, but by using a debit card, you're just throwing those points away. Obviously, don't use a credit card irresponsibly. If you're using a credit card, you should treat it like a debit card and pay it off each month. You should never accumulate credit card debt because it's at a super high interest rate. That's a really bad idea. But assuming you're confident that you're going to use a credit card like a debit card and pay it off each month, get a credit card, earn those points, you know, on Amex or Chase or something like that. Again, a lot of this advice is applicable to a US audience mostly because those can book you free flights using airline points. And there are plenty of resources online where you can find out the tips and tricks on how to do that well. Any notes on points?
I have no idea how credit cards work.
I was a real bad points boy for a long time, and I've just now started using them. And let me tell you, folks, it's free money.
Good. Free money.
I will say you do have to be careful with credit cards, though. Like, even if you do pay it all the way off, you have to be careful not to put too much on a credit card necessarily. Like, I recently moved, and I was like buying a lot of furniture. So like I was spending quite a lot of money in a short period of time. And I put it all on my credit card because I was like, I want to get the points. And my credit score dropped by like 30 points in like a month, even though I paid the whole thing off, like immediately, like I paid my full bill like at the end of the month. But if you use up too much of your credit limit, then you can get in trouble. So it actually counterintuitively is better to have multiple credit cards and to spread it out a little bit. So maybe if you can get like a Chase Sapphire and an Amex Platinum, which I think most people would agree are the two best ones if you're able to get them, or if you can't, like work your way up to those.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing with credit cards is like, it's worth also in general using a credit card, especially if you're younger, to start building your credit history.
Absolutely.
The credit score system in the US is super annoying for, I mean, the reasons Adam just described and plenty of others. But the thing is, a lot of what counts is credit history, how long you've been earning a credit score. So even if you're, you know, 18 years old, you've just gotten your first bank account and everything, you're not going to be able to get a very good credit card at all. In fact, the credit card that you are probably going to be able to get is going to be a secured credit card, most likely, where you have to put, like, for example, a $500 deposit down and you only get a $500 credit limit. So it's essentially zero risk to the credit card company. It's still worth doing that so you can start to earn a credit score so you can get the better credit cards. And eventually, you know, what's going to matter is hopefully, but maybe less realistically so these days, you can use that to like get a good mortgage 10, 15, 20 years down the line. Because the better credit score you have, the lower interest rate you're going to be able to get on a mortgage. And this will also impact other things like loans and stuff like that. So having a good credit score is worth it. And starting early really counts.
But even if you're a renter, you need a good credit score sometimes to get an apartment.
Yeah. So worth doing early as long as you are responsible. This has really delved into financial advice over travel advice. But we have so many other subjects to cover in more on the travel side. Oh, hotels. This is one other thing that kind of a similar deal to credit cards. Hotels are something where, in my opinion, it is worth booking through something like Expedia or Hotels.com. I really like Hotels.com because how Hotels.com works is for every 10 nights you book, they'll give you a free night credit. And that free night credit is equal to the average value of those 10 nights that earned it. So essentially, you get 10% back. So it's worth booking through hotels.com over just like booking directly with Hilton or something because you get that 10% back. Of course, Hilton will give you points and stuff, but you got to really do that a lot for it to be worth it. So I recommend hotels.com, but I do not officially endorse them, I think. No, I don't want to officially endorse them. They got to pay me for that.
Maybe one day.
Yeah, make them pay us.
True. Yeah, they'd actually be a good sponsor. Too bad Daddy Nebula is such a good sponsor, too. They're going to have to pay a lot.
So true.
Should we quickly say rail passes are cool?
Rail
passes are great.
We've proven that rail passes are cool.
Rail passes are real cool.
And we're about to prove it again.
Yeah. Really like a great way to, you know, you just fly to Europe. Of course, it's expensive for like an American to get to Europe. But you just fly to Europe and then you can just go everywhere on these rail passes. Like you can really pack in a lot and see all the highlights in just like a week or two.
Well, this is one other thing about travel, and this is somewhat specific to Europe. If you need to get somewhere in Europe, recently I had a friend and they needed to get to Rome for a wedding. And I was helping him book travel for him and his dad. And I was like, okay, I was looking at all these options and getting to Rome was just like really expensive on the days that he needed to get there. And eventually I was like, here's what you should do. Like, fly to Milan, which is way cheaper, especially on Thursdays, just by the way, if you fly Neos, and then just take the train to Rome from Milan. And it'll take a few hours and it'll be a pleasant ride. And, you know, you can stop in, I think he's going to stop in Florence and like have a lovely little trip. And it's like rail travel is longer, but it's also so much more pleasant that like it's often worth a longer rail travel as opposed to a shorter flight, especially considering you can often save quite a lot of money. If I want to get to Paris, there's no reason I need to necessarily fly into Paris. Like, I could fly into London if it was a lot cheaper and I could just take the train.
Yeah, make the journey the destination. All right, should we argue about bags?
Oh yeah, let's argue about bags.
Should we check a bag?
No,
no.
Of course not.
What if you need things?
Put them in your carry-on.
What if you need more things?
You don't need a lot of things.
You don't need as many things. This is something that people have wondered, I think, about the show. Because I think if you don't travel a lot, like, I think most people who don't travel a lot or travel a normal amount tend to way overpack.
Way overpack. I used to, for sure.
Yeah. Because it's like, I don't know, it's scary. It's like you're going far away. Maybe you need stuff. And it turns out you just you don't really need as much stuff as you think you do. And I mean, we've been able to exist quite comfortably, I'd say, out of just not even massive backpacks.
No.
For like a week. I mean, maybe if you're going somewhere for more than a week.
I mean, we traveled for 5 days and had to pack in such a way where we could have ended up in any country in the world. And I still only needed a backpack.
Yeah. On top of that, it's like we didn't even have suitcases. So we could have had that backpack and a suitcase in the overhead and still not had to check a bag.
Yeah. If you have like a pretty big backpack, airlines will always assume that it's your personal item, not your carry-on, even if it's closer to carry-on size.
Always with an asterisk.
Yeah.
If you're on a budget airline, they can be quite strict.
They can, but I've never experienced it once, for what it's worth. They've never questioned it.
Yeah, I've gotten nixed on budget airlines before, but that's kind of to be expected. What I'll say about this is I think I take a slightly different approach with it. I travel quite a lot. I travel more than 100 nights a year. So that's to say, probably about 1 in 3 days of the year I'm traveling because I have a lot of travel on top of jet lag. And I always try to think about, you know, the context of the trip itself on whether or not to check a bag. Here's the question. What is the downside of checking a bag? It's worth considering the downsides. One downside is that you quite often have to wait, say, 30 minutes at the other end for your bag to come out. I would say 30 minutes is a good average.
And at the front, because you have to check the bag.
Yeah, of course, yeah. You got to check your bag too. And sometimes those lines can be pretty significant. So it essentially means you have to arrive to the airport earlier and you're going to leave on the other end later. The other thing to consider is like there's pretty decent risk sometimes of your bag getting left behind. If you're on a nonstop flight between two places, I think the risk is very low. I can't think of a time when my bag has not come through when I was on a nonstop flight because there's not a whole lot that can go wrong. Where things can go wrong is with connections because sometimes the bag gets missorted. Sometimes it can't make a quick connection. Especially the very high risk scenario is if your first flight is delayed to the point where you have a really, really short connection, you are often able to outrun your bag. So you might be able to make the connection, your bag won't make the connection, and then you might be waiting for the next day for your bag to arrive. There's also the situation where like if something goes wrong and a flight gets canceled, rebooking is always gonna be tougher if you have a bag. One of the first questions the reservations agent will ask you when you go up to get rebooked is, do you have a bag? Because if you do have a bag, that means that they have to send an individual human out to find your bag in the system and put a new label on it and put it back in the right place. And it can be a while, especially if there's a lot going on that day, if there's like a lot of weather issues, until there's like a human available to do that. So if you get into a really messy kind of storm disruption or something, your bag could be lost for days. One other scenario is like you're flying back into the US. When you fly back into the US, rather uniquely compared to the rest of the world, you have to clear customs with your bag immediately at the first port of entry into the US. So say you fly into LAX and you're connecting to Denver, you have to wait for your bag in LAX to take it through customs and then recheck it in to go to Denver. Not only is that like annoying and a waste of time, it means that like if you have a short connection, you could miss your second flight because of the time you're just waiting around for your bag because you can't leave behind. You need to recheck it. So there's a lot of risks to it. So I think it's worth considering and knowing those risks to balance on whether or not it's worth it. But there have been times myself where it's like, I don't know, I'm flying to say London and I'm going to be there for 10 days. And it's a simple itinerary both ways, no complexity. So it's like, okay, it's worth, you know, the 30 minutes on each end just to be able to pack more stuff and flexibly and have space to buy stuff and all that. But yeah, I guess I'll sum it up with saying, I agree with what Ben and Adam say that like, often I think people overpack as like a symptom of just like trip anxiety, of just like all these different things I might need. And what if I need this? And what if I need that? And what if I want to change my outfits? And what if I get delayed and stuff like that? So planning ahead is really worth it. Like thinking about what are the things I need, even writing them down. Sometimes, especially for jet lag, I'll make like a packing spreadsheet to be able to figure out exactly like I will need this many pairs of socks. And then usually I will be like, okay, I actually need less of that pairs of socks because I don't have the room for everything because we really like having small bags. But yes, anything else to say about packing?
I mean, in terms of packing, I think that when you're packing, you need to like accept that like you are not when you travel, necessarily going to have access to all of the things you would have if you were at home, and that's okay. It's like, you know what? Like, maybe you just bring one pair of shoes. It's the ones you're wearing. And if you go to a kind of nice dinner, maybe you just don't wear dress shoes. You just wear your shoes. Cause like, you know what?
You'll probably never see those people again.
You're traveling and you don't need to wear dress shoes to dinner. Cause who cares? And like, shoes are so heavy and take up so much room in bags that if you can avoid bringing extra pairs of shoes, like, it's so worth it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the other thing I'll say is just like, I think this is also a travel anxiety symptom, but like, it is important to remember that, like, unless you're going somewhere really crazy, you can just get the stuff that you need there if you forget something. Like, people forget that, like, if you don't pack enough socks and you're traveling to Europe, you can get socks in Europe. It's not that hard.
Europe has socks.
They have socks there, yeah.
You're not going to believe it, but Europe does have socks.
And I feel like, and it makes sense, like, people often forget that most of the world is very accessible and people live there and, like, you can fix problems once you arrive. So it's not worth worrying that much.
Yeah. Wool shirts is my other big tip. This is a tip I got from Scotty from Strange Parts, who's our guest for Japan. He was like, wool shirts don't smell even after you wear them for a few days because wool is kind of magical. So if you pack wool shirts, there's a great company called Icebreaker that makes wool shirts, like light t-shirts, but that are made of wool. And you can wear one of those boys for 2-3 days and no problem at all.
Some people will even like bring like dry detergent with them and wash their clothes in like a hotel room sink. Like surprisingly common with people who travel a ton. And it gets the job done somewhat. You can even do mid-trip laundry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can even just find a laundromat too to do a more serious version. Or if like you're in an Airbnb or something, they might have
that's
one.
True too.
Even some hotels even have like coin laundry. It's worth checking.
Oh, well, do we want to give a shout out to Cotopaxi, who I think makes the best travel backpacks around?
Yeah, we're not sponsored.
Yes, but what if we get another travel backpack sponsor?
That's true. We might.
Cotopaxi is the best travel backpack until someone pays us more for us to tell them that they're the best travel backpack company.
I will point out that we all started using Cotopaxis sort of independently of one another. So it kind of looks like we're sponsored, but no, we just all like those backpacks.
They're just fun and funky and colorful and somewhat ethical, despite being owned by a venture capital firm.
Yay.
They're like Patagonia, but even more woke, I think. But yeah, let's get to the airport, figuratively, not literally. Airports are stressful.
Yes.
If you're not checking a bag, don't go to the counter.
Oh, yeah. God.
There is almost always an airline app.
Don't go to the counter.
Yeah.
Use the app to get your boarding pass. My God, please. Or you could use the kiosks if they have kiosks.
Yep.
Although you shouldn't even need to use the kiosks because you should always be able to get your boarding pass on mobile. There's very few scenarios in which you can't do this. Most of them involve, well, they used to involve international travel where you had to present COVID documents at the counter, but that is largely no longer the case.
Although, for what it's worth, I will say going to talk to people in person can get you around a lot of things that the airlines
that
say they can't do.
Yes.
Like, oftentimes I've been able to, like, rebook myself on a flight that would otherwise cost money to rebook myself onto, or any number of other things.
I've been able to cancel flights for free and get out of fees and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, that's a whole other bullet point that you get into.
Yeah, yeah, that's another bullet point.
But yeah, don't go to the counter. You know, Alaska Airlines is getting rid of their kiosks because they're like, nobody needs a kiosk anymore. Like the touchscreen ones.
Because of the app?
Wow. No more kiosks.
Their point is like, they're one of two scenarios. Either like you can do the same thing with an app, which is true, you know, get your boarding pass with the app on your smartphone, and everyone has a smartphone except for the people that don't, I guess. But for the people that don't, they're going to have to go to the counter anyway. So the only two kind of paths is either you use the app to get your boarding pass or you go to a human, but they really try to make you not go to the human. So they're trialing this in Portland. And then the idea is that they're going to roll it out across all of their airports. Anyways, what should we wear?
I have two pieces of advice on this. I actually have three. I might figure out more. One, wear something comfortable, obviously. I always travel in sweatpants. Two, layers are usually a very good idea because planes, temperature can be confusing and often they'll end up getting cold, but like only like in the middle of the flight and stuff. Or sometimes there's a thing that happens if you're on a longer flight, you get cold when you fall asleep because like your body shuts down. That's why you sleep under a lot of covers because your body gets chilly when you sleep often. So like having a good sturdy like sweatshirt or even like a jacket that you can put on when you're on the plane at the point at which the plane gets cold can be quite key. And also I would say always travel in long pants. I would never recommend traveling in shorts, both for temperature reasons when you ultimately get on the plane and also for your legs being raw on airplane seats is gross.
Airplanes are gross.
And the last thing I would say is travel in clothes that you know are not a problem for security. Like I have certain like sweatpants that have zippers and stuff that always get flagged by security. So I usually don't travel in those.
Yeah, I think I'd add as a sub point to the travel comfortably bit, two sub points actually. Travel, especially long haul flying when you're like sitting down in a small seat for like 12, 14, 16 hours sometimes, it messes with your GI tract, with your gastrointestinal tubes and stuff quite a lot. So make sure to not to wear something tight. Because if you're wearing like rather tight pants that are going to be like constricting your body for 12, 14, 16 hours, that is probably going to make you feel less good. I pretty much always travel in like joggers, basically. Actually, more recent that I'll do that over just like normal pants. Super comfy and comfy to sleep in, comfy to walk around in, everything. I know a lot of people, especially older people, they're like, why don't people dress up to travel anymore? Well, first of all, because we're not mortgaging our houses to get on one flight anymore. It's kind of just a regular thing.
We also don't have houses to mortgage.
Right. Yes, that too.
Well, you do, I suppose, but we don't.
I have a condo, yeah, technically, over a house, but I do have a mortgage, yes. There's also this like weird urban legend of like, if you're dressed up enough and they need to upgrade people to business class, they'll upgrade you. 0% true. There's zero validity to that rumor that if you're dressed nice, they'll upgrade you to business class, at least these days. Airlines have a very defined system for how to upgrade people to business class for free. And it always goes to people who have like frequent flyer status in a very defined and systematic order based on things like how high their status is, how long they've been status members, how far in advance they booked, how much they paid, stuff like that. So the cases in which there are so many open seats that they're just getting to people who are dressed nicely, they just never really arise. So don't worry about that. And I wear sweatpants and sweatshirts to like airport lounges all the time. And nobody ever has an issue. So I say travel comfortably. Should we talk about jet lag?
Whoa.
I have thoughts and feelings about jet lag.
Yeah, I thought season 2 was the worst.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people think that.
I actually thought season 2... Oh, we're making a joke. Because I was going to say season 2, I never experienced jet lag on season 2 because time wasn't real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, time didn't exist.
And so like it never got to me anyway, but we were making a joke.
That's one approach, yeah. Let's talk about jet lag, the phenomena. The thing about jet lag that's interesting is jet lag as a phenomena has only existed for about 60 or 70 years. There was never a form of transport until the last 60 or 70 years that you would move fast enough to be able to experience jet lag. Because what happens is like your body has an internal clock that releases things like melatonin to make you tired at a certain amount of time so you get to sleep at the normal time. And that internal clock will keep going even when you switch time zones. So it'll keep releasing all those different fun hormones and stuff at the same time. So what it's really about is getting through those initial days and sometimes weeks when your body is still releasing the hormones at that predetermined time. People say it takes a full 14 days to fully get over jet lag. I think that's really just to get over all the effects. It depends on age. It depends on the person. As you get older, it gets tougher to get over jet lag. Different people have different susceptibility to it. There's a certain level of just kind of training you can do for it. But a lot of it is just about what you do leading up to leaving rather than after you arrive. A lot of it is what happens after you arrive, but a lot of it is how you lead up to leaving. So for example, this past season when we were flying to Japan, the situation was that we had in Ben and Adam's case, we had a, I think, 10:30 a.m. flight that was gonna take 14 hours to go nonstop to Tokyo. and we would arrive. We were flying westbound. We would arrive at 2:30-ish p.m. Tokyo time. We ended up having travel shenanigans that meant that wasn't the case, but that's what we were preparing for. So it's a bit of a tricky one because we were going 11 hours backwards in time. And once we got to Tokyo, we needed to be sure that we would stay up from when we arrived until a reasonable bedtime, because we would be super, super tired because when we arrived, it'd be the middle of the night. So we would have to prepare ourselves when we arrived to stay up for 6, 7, 8 hours. So what I did to prepare for that, for example, is I restricted my sleeping that night before leaving. It happened that we had the finale for season 5 event the night prior. And then we, you know, went to a bar after that and everything. So I didn't get home until like 1 a.m. So I slept like 3 hours, woke up at 4 a.m., caffeinated, so that by the time that I got to the flight, I would be tired again to sleep on the flight. Because sleeping on the flight was going to be necessary so that on the other end, I would be able to stay up for 8 or so hours. So that's the thing you got to do. I mean, once you get there, the answer is pretty much always the same. It's really just like you got to immediately stick to local sleeping hours, as tough as it is. Sometimes I suggest a tactical nap, but you got to be really confident that you can make your nap tactical.
A tactical nap can be quite effective, but yes, you really have to actually make it a nap and not early bedtime.
Yeah. So if I do a tactical nap, I will set like 20 alarms after it to make sure that there is zero possibility, because sometimes it's going to feel like death when you wake up after a 1 hour nap and you're jet lagged and everything, but you have to wake up or you will ruin your sleep schedule for days.
I mean, this is one thing I'll say about the naps is like, I try to avoid naps just because the effects of sleep deprivation are so much worse after a nap than if you can just distract yourself. But like once you've had that little taste of sleep, it can sometimes be so much worse. Mm-hmm. So best to just like, if you can, go out and like do stuff until you pass out.
Yeah. Sunlight helps a lot.
Sunlight is, what I was going to say. Sunlight is huge. Like, your body responds very significantly to, like, sunlight. Like, we are simple creatures whose internal clocks and hormones are affected quite a lot by sunlight. So, like, being out in sunlight when you want to feel awake is super helpful.
Yeah, and that's to say, it's not, like, just a psychological thing. It's, like, being in the sunlight will actually restrict the hormones that create tiredness, like melatonin. Yes. They will restrict melatonin from being released to the same level. So it's not just tricking your brain, it's actually tricking your body. Because sunlight is how the body knows when to release these hormones and everything. So your body will be confused. And it's worth knowing that like jet lag can be an all body phenomenon. So these things can disrupt things like, again, like your GI tract, for example, because your body is so confused, but eventually you'll get over it. So it's really just about really those first 48 hours, 36 to 48 hours is when it's tough. And then I think after that, get into the swing of it. I think one last note for me is this is a time when it's, in my opinion, worth using caffeine, using melatonin, using sleeping pills. I think a lot of people, rightfully so, try to avoid using things like caffeine and melatonin on a regular basis. But, you know, jet lag is not a regular thing. So I will not personally feel bad about having 3 Red Bulls or something to get through the day after a long haul flight, or, you know, having melatonin to get to sleep or stuff like that. It's a time worth using it.
The last thing I would add is just like use tactical use of sleep eye masks on flights in order to better adjust yourself is often a good idea. Because what happens is airlines choose when to turn on and off the lights. My understanding is they do almost sort of like an average-ish of like the 2 time zones, like the one you're leaving from and the one you're arriving to, but like almost like skewed towards where you left from because they want people to be comfortable on the flight.
The truth is it's just completely down to the flight attendants. Like there's no system for it. It's just what the flight attendants decide.
It's largely chaos.
It always feels weird.
And so what you should do is you should go in knowing like the way to approach this flight is sleep as much as possible in the beginning of it and then stay up for the rest, or like stay up as long as possible, then sleep all the way at the end or whatever. And using a sleep mask to make the conditions for sleep be what you know they should be based on your jet lag needs is going to be much better than just being at the whims of whatever the flight attendants do.
Yeah, and I keep saying last thing, but this kind of relates to another one. And I think this one, at least for me, helps a lot. Related to like the get out, go to sunlight kind of thing. The other thing is just like doing things, yeah. Especially if it's a leisure trip, plan things to do right away. You know, one of the worst jet lag trips in existence, in my opinion, is US East Coast to Europe. Because then you're usually on a flight that leaves rather early in the evening, like 6 or 7 p.m. So earlier than you would normally get to sleep. And it's only 6 hours long. So it's really tough to get meaningful sleep. And then you get there at like 7 a.m. And then you're often not able to get into your hotel room until like 3 p.m. It sucks. But the way to counter it is like plan fun stuff to do. Make a breakfast reservation, make a lunch reservation. Sometimes what helps for me is like I'll immediately like go to the gym or go on a run or something to, you know, get the body moving, get over it, get a shower. That's the other thing. If you go to like the hotel gym, there's often showers that you can go to there too, even before you get into your room. Basically just do things. Distract yourself from how you're physically feeling.
I had a friend recently who was going on like the longest flight he'd ever been on. He was going to the Philippines. And he was like, what is your advice for how to deal with long haul flights? And what I said to him, which I really think is true, is like, you just sort of have to give yourself over to the experience of being a passenger and just sort of accept the situation that you're in and almost enter sort of like a focused Zen state to like make it through all of it. Like, I think that like when you are a human existing in the normal world, like you have certain expectations about a level of freedom of your movement and like a level of comfort and a level of not being stuck in a place unable to leave for 14 hours. And like, you just have to like really lock in to this mindset of Zen of just like, I am a passenger on a vessel and this is what I am right now. And you just have to like give yourself over to that experience, I think. And if you do that, you just let all of the uncomfortableness wash over you like a wave. And like that to me is really the way to do it. Like, I think that that mindset was the only way that we survived doing circumnavigation.
Absolutely. As someone experienced with it, like I almost find it kind of calming sometimes. It's like, there's nothing I really need to do besides just like follow instructions. Just, you know, get in this line, do that. I'll often pop my earbuds in to just like filter out all the chaos of the airport. Mm-hmm. And it's just like very calming. I love it.
Well, also you can like take advantage of the isolation and the fact that you can't do anything else. Like sometimes there will be situations where it's like, there's a video game I've wanted to sink my teeth into, but I can't because like I live in the world and I have things to do. But when you're trapped somewhere for 14 hours and you can't do anything else, like it is a good opportunity to do those things that you wouldn't normally be able to do with responsibilities.
Yeah, treating it as an opportunity. Well, I would also say like, and this is a word about like how to plan out the entertainment that you bring for things. I don't overpack, but I over-download for sure. And I recommend that others over-download as well, because I find that like the thing it turns out I'm in the mood for, I often have no idea what mood I'm going to be in until I'm in the air. And I'll discover, oh, shoot, this TV show was the one that I got into, but I only downloaded 2 episodes. So now I'm screwed. And so like I tend to download a lot of things and download many, many, many episodes of a TV show in case it turns out that when I get in the air, all I want to do is watch. In the case of when we were doing Tag Across Europe, Better Call Saul was the, turned out the only thing I wanted to watch. And luckily I had downloaded a ton of it going in.
Okay, I got one last one. Pack snacks.
Pack snacks.
The food they feed you on the airplane, at least in my experience, is very rarely enough to keep up with my hunger level on a very long flight. And the worst feeling in the world is I am starving and there is no way to get food because I am stuck in a metal tube 40,000 feet above the Pacific Ocean. So yeah, pack some snacks. Even better, pack snacks, you know, from like a CVS at home rather than paying exorbitant airport snack prices because you will very likely want them.
Well, one thing I will add to that is that you can, and I did this recently on the way back from Japan, I got really hungry and like it was like lights out time. You can just ask flight attendants for food and they'll just bring it to you.
Yeah.
Like you can just hit the little help button.
Ooh, that's controversial.
And the light comes on. And then when they come to you, just be like, can I have a snack? They'll be like, yeah. And they brought me like a banana and like chips and like a bunch of other things. And I ate all of them. And then I was still hungry and I hit it again. And I said, could I have 3 more bags of chips? And they were like, yup. And they brought them to me.
It depends on the airline though, whether they'll have snacks stocked.
It depends slightly on the airline, but especially if it's a long haul, they'll normally do it.
Usually, especially if it's not like a budget airline.
I will say one more thing about food. So you usually only get like 2 options of like what you can eat if they have like a meal at a given time. And oftentimes they just are out of whatever the clearly best one is. But you can usually, most airlines let you like on the app or whatever, pick your meal ahead of time, which is oftentimes worthwhile so that you don't get stuck with something that you don't want to eat at all.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's talk about how to enjoy a place.
It's a very wide-ranging topic.
Hey, you wrote the bullet point.
I can start off because I wrote the bullet point. I mean, I have a lot of things I could say about this, but you know, one of the most common questions that we get about jet lag is like, are you able to enjoy the places that you go? And I think that we get that question less often now because we spend more time in the places where we are. Like when we circumnavigated, you know, we only spent a few hours in each place. I would say that one thing that jet lag, I think, has taught me about cool ways to experience a place is really the kind of getting off the beaten path and like how to wander well kind of concept. Like, and we sort of first got a taste of this in Tag Across Europe. And I won't speak too much to, you know, any of the mechanics of Japan, but I would say that there was some of this in Japan as well, of like, just ending up in a cool place that like is not a tourist place and just like going there and checking it out and just like getting to experience a somewhat authentic slice of life in an unusual place is like, I think, a really worthwhile thing to do in travel. Like, especially if you're at a place that has trains, like Europe or Japan or, you know, somewhere like that, like just get on a train going somewhere and like just get off somewhere. Like, make sure that there's like a town there or something, but just like get off somewhere and just like walk around and check it out. Like spending a day just wandering, it doesn't have to be your whole trip, but doing like, you know what, today I'm just going to go to random areas in the south of France. I'm just going to get off the train and check it out and get a snack and walk around. And, you know, most French towns are very beautiful and have, you know, like some sort of like park or town hall or like memorial or whatever. And then just hop back on the train and go somewhere else. And like, maybe you don't even know where you're going to sleep that night, but you'll be able to find somewhere. You'll be fine. Like, I think that's a really worthwhile thing to implement into your travel. It's just like wander around, especially if there's a good train network. You can just go to all kinds of fun little places and like check them out and feel like you're experiencing a place in a way where you aren't standing in a line of 300 people all trying to look at the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my best memories of travel are always like, you know, I don't remember what it's like visiting Notre Dame, but I do remember Beauge or whatever that town was. Just because, like, yeah, it is a more authentic experience of a place to just go somewhere weird. It's not highly curated.
Yeah, one advice that I think sometimes comes with this is, like, doing, I think, what's called, like, purposeful wandering when you're in, like, a foreign city where, like, you have all the tools these days to be able to just truly just wander with zero consequences. Basically, you always have your smartphone. You can always call an Uber. You can always look at a map. You can always get back from any situation that you might encounter.
Yes.
But, you know, of course, there are nuances of this. Like, don't do this in the middle of night. Don't do it in a sketchy area. It might be different, you know, depending on if you're a solo traveler, for example. But, like, you can always just, like, get on a street, walk, and then, like, decide. Like, don't look at your phone. Don't look at Google Maps. Just go where it's interesting. When you get to an intersection, look, here's a road, here's a road, here's a road. Which one looks most interesting? Follow it. Keep doing that. Like, literally just wander. People almost never have the opportunity these days to just wander and truly just wander, like purposeful wandering. It's such a delightful phenomena. and you'll find cool things, and it'll lead to a sense of wonder.
In a sense of discovery, like authentic discovery.
Yeah, wonder, not wander, but wonder is one of those psychological phenomena that is most associated with producing serotonin and all the happy chemicals. Fun fact. So doing the situation that encourages that feeling of wonder, that feeling of discovery, will, science says, it'll lead to happiness. It'll lead to having a good time. So definitely encourage that and absolutely echo the, you know, get off the beaten track. There's nothing wrong with going to the Eiffel Tower or going to the Notre Dame or anything like that. Like, there's obviously a place for going to the top spots. But I think what it's really about is like, find time to not do the top rated stuff on TripAdvisor. Find time to find cool things, not to go to cool things, to find them.
Yes.
To create a scenario in which you are taking a risk on whether or not you'll find something cool. And you probably will if you do it right.
Yes. Absolutely. Now, I'd like to add something that goes against the entire ethos of all of this.
Great.
Which is about food, which is that I personally, being, I think we would all agree, the biggest foodie of the three of us.
Sure.
Am a big believer in reviews by professional reviewers and not crowdsourced reviews when it comes to food. I think that crowdsourced reviews for food are largely garbage. A lot of it, first of all, is straight up fake. And people pay for reviews. Second of all, a lot of it is just like completely dependent on the standard. It's just so subjectively dependent on like how many people go to these places, what kinds of people go to them, those people's own subjective standards, the number of reviews, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of it is weirdly based on like survey. It's anyway. I think crowdsourced reviews are awful. And there are people whose whole job it is to be professional food reviewers. And they are experts on this. And they know how to ask locals. Or they usually are locals, people who are writing about, you know, cities. They are locals whose whole thing is finding cool and good places to eat and assessing them. And use those. Like, if you're in an unfamiliar city, usually, like, Eater or Infatuation will have a great guide to really, really good restaurants there. A lot of cities will have a Michelin guide, which, I mean, you know, if you're going to the Michelin star restaurants, it'll often be expensive. But, you know, Bib Gourmand is a really useful tool that the Michelin guide puts out, which is like affordable-ish restaurants that it recommends. And you can use that, like local newspapers often. Like, I was in Houston recently, and so I looked up like the best barbecue places according to like a Houston like magazine, right? Like the people who know these local areas. But anyway, use professional food reviewers to find good food. This is my strongly held belief.
My only food tip is do not, under any circumstances, try to eat Mexican food anywhere other than the United States or Mexico.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what it is, but no other part of the world can make Mexican food. I don't know why.
So true.
But that is the case.
They cannot do it. They simply have not figured it out.
Yep. I think a lot of times, one cool way of traveling is to go to a country like the UK, like a lot of European countries, like Australia, New Zealand, places that are different, but familiar enough where you can really confidently like get out there. As an American, you can navigate Australia pretty much as well as you can navigate America.
Yeah.
You can decide which scenarios are safe and unsafe, figure out which areas to go to and all that. So being able to go to a place like that and confidently, without real worry, get out there, I think that's worth a lot. And I think that's why a lot of Americans, you know, despite the fact that like Europe is not actually that foreign or different, at least culturally compared to the US, compared to a place like, I don't know, China. But what makes it cool is like, because of that, you can really get out there. So I think there's definitely value in that kind of travel.
I would say one little tip that I have, I mean, for Americans listening, is like, if you haven't, exploring America is really worthwhile. And I think a lot of Americans have not gone to many of the most beautiful areas of America. Like, I had been to so many places before I went to the American Southwest. And like, the American Southwest is so incredible and beautiful. Like, go see the Grand Canyon. Go to like Zion National Park. Go to like Bryce. Like, go see these things. Like, it's so beautiful and so striking. And the first time I went to the Southwest, I was like, I can't believe I haven't been here before. Like, it's incredible. And it's in America. You know, it's like in my backyard. And I like couldn't believe that I had never made the effort to go out there.
As someone who lives in that area, I don't know if I want that in there. I want to gatekeep it a little bit more.
Yeah, no, I know. I will say, with in terms of the Grand Canyon is the most like lives up to the hype thing I've ever been to. Mm-hmm. You got to go to Grand Canyon South. This is important. Go to the south view of the Grand Canyon. Absolutely lives up to the hype, exceeds the hype, mm-hmm. in my opinion.
Yeah, for what it's worth, similar thing where, like, you know, it is worth going to the actual Grand Canyon, but a lot of that experience you can get in a way less touristy context. And a lot of the rest of Arizona and Utah, especially Utah, despite its, let's say, political weirdness, is a fantastic state. And if you follow the Colorado River basically upstream, you can get a lot of good canyon experiences with way less people. It's still worth going to the Grand Canyon itself. But yeah, that entire area, like basically, I think a lot of what we're saying across the board is just like, go deep with your travel.
Yes.
Don't just go to Paris and see the Eiffel Tower. Don't just go to London and see the London Eye. What's really worth it is like getting really out there into a country.
Definitely. Definitely. Yes.
Yeah.
In summary, I think before we started doing jet lag, travel felt like something that was so difficult to do in terms of the planning of it all, like so prohibitively hard to like make happen and required so much advanced preparation. And like, you know, obviously you have to take off from work if you're going to be traveling for a significant period of time. And obviously it can be expensive and all those things. But like, I think doing this show has really taught me like, you can just get up and go places. And like, you can often do it for a lot less money than you think if you're willing to be flexible about it. And like, with a lot less planning than you think. And still have an incredible time and arguably a better time sometimes than if you had done like way too much planning. Like, just get up and go places. Like, if you have 5 days, you could go to Europe. If you leave at the right time, like, $450. You can get there round trip and just like go around and like, I don't know. It's, and I know I say this from a place of privilege, but like, I just think travel is more accessible and less expensive and requires less preparation than most people think that it does.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Yeah.
And obviously I also say this as an American who can travel visa free to places, like, you know, we speak with a lot of privilege, but still.
I remember when I told people we had successfully circumnavigated the globe. You know, the question people always have is like, oh my God, how did you do that? And it's like, I don't know. It's like, it's not that complicated. It's like, we didn't even have our laptops. We just used our phones and we got all the way around the world. And like, it cost way less money than you think it would. And we did it way faster than you think you could. It's just like, travel is easier than most people think. I think that is a good takeaway.
Yeah. And I think a lot of what we've said kind of also sums up to like, what makes for the best travel experiences is really living in a foreign place for a couple of days. It's not about taking the boxes. It's not about taking photos in front of landmarks. It's about experiencing life in a different context, experiencing how people living in a different place live similarly to you in some ways and different in other ways, and really just experiencing that on a human level. So I think part of the reason why we say like, don't be worried if you haven't plan too much is because you kind of want to have those moments where you can not have a plan, where you can go off the cuff, where you can decide that I'm going to wander down the street and end up at this restaurant and stuff like that, because that's what living is in a foreign place. It's not, again, it's not the landmarks. It's not standing in line. It's not TripAdvisor reviewed places. It's getting out there. It's figuring it out as you go along and stuff like that. So surrender yourself to the chaos. Embrace the complexity, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, travel is a beautiful thing. Travel more. It really is like one of the most incredible things that you're able to do in this life.
Yep.
All right. See you next week when we do who knows what. We'll figure it out.
We don't know. Yep. Thank you for listening again. Pretty soon, actually, we'll be kind of pivoting to some season 6 oriented stuff. We haven't announced a release date yet, but we're going to start to do like talking about season 6 stuff soon.
Soon.
Yay.
But anyways, bye.
Bye. Bye.